Hello, it's Tuesday the 9th of August and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. At least 8 people have died and 6 more have been reported missing after downpours pounded the central region on Monday, with Seoul seeing the highest rainfall on record. We'll have more details on News Briefing shortly. North Korea is expected to declare an end to the COVID-19 epidemic within the regime after they reported 0 suspected cases in 11 days. We take a closer look at their situation for our in-depth today. And then coming up, we ask how we can argue better to improve our relationships and society with 2-time world debate champion Bors Ha. Let's begin Korea 24. The Korean Peninsula has been inundated with the worst rainfall in decades, with much of the damage being reported in the capital region. President Yoon Suk-yeol has called for a thorough management of this ongoing deluge, continue through Friday. For more on this and our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by our KBS World Radio news editor, Eunice Kim. Eunice, hello.
Hello.
As dawn broke this morning, we got a better picture of how bad this second monsoon run has been. One area of Seoul received 1 month's worth of rain in a single day in what is now a deadly storm in the country's central region. Can you update us on the latest?
Yeah, absolutely. We are seeing localized heavy rainfall with this deluge. Some areas of the capital region spared, but other areas debilitated with flash flooding in Gangnam neighborhoods, power outages, and subway stations and living units inundated. This is being called the heaviest rainfall in 80 years, pointing to the 136.5 millimeters of rain Shindaebang in Seoul's Dongjak district got over a single hour through 9 p.m. on Monday, breaking the previous record of 118.6 millimeters. Millimeter set 8 decades ago on August 5, 1942. Now, the KMA said Shindaebang saw 381.5 millimeters of rain on Monday, which exceeds another record of 354.7 millimeters set in August of 1920, that is over 100 years ago, Chang'o, when records began to be kept. Gwangju and Gwangmyeong in Gyeonggi province saw 327.5 millimeters and 319 millimeters of precipitation, respectively. Aside from the growing list of property damage, this has been, unfortunately, a fatal downpour. We are hearing at least 8 people have died of storm-related causes as of 3 p.m. Tuesday, according to the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters. At least 7 were missing and 9 others injured across Seoul, Gyeonggi province, and Incheon, though this list is expected to grow. One sad case involves a family of 3, among them a handicapped woman, who drowned in their half-basement living quarters in the said Dongjak district when water levels rose in seconds, neighbors who tried to rescue them said.
President Yoon Suk-yeol is said to have monitored reports throughout the night and convened an emergency meeting of related agencies on Tuesday, Eunice.
Yeah, and we heard the Seoul mayor, Oh Se-hoon, also dashed back to City Hall last night as the intensity of this storm culminated in report after report. As to the meeting you referred to, President Yoon expressed deep regret over the casualties from the torrential rainfall and ordered related agencies and local governments to boost their emergency operation systems to prevent further casualties. The Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters said President Yoon ordered authorities to thoroughly restrict passage to areas prone to flooding, including underpasses, riversides, and low-lying areas that often have become inundated with water, and also for evacuations in areas prone to mudslides or those areas devastated by forest fires. President Yoon stressed that protecting the lives and assets of the people is a government's most fundamental task and duty before instructing related agencies and local governments to remain vigilant.
And the heavy rainfall is expected to continue at least through Thursday for the central regions before it moves to the southern areas of the country by Friday. How much more rain are we expecting?
Yeah, anywhere between 100 and 300 millimeters more rain could fall in the central region through the day after tomorrow. This is according to the KMA. The dry air mass is expected to move further south on Friday to impact South Chungcheong, North Jeolla, and North Gyeongsang provinces. Although the capital region should expect some respite on Thursday morning, the weather agency said the stationary front will head back north, once again drenching the capital region and Gangwon province by Thursday afternoon. The KMA warning that any region with a strong rain cloud formation could see up to 100 millimeters of rain per hour. So please do be mindful and be careful when you navigate the storm.
Indeed. Let's move on to the COVID-19 situation in South Korea. The daily case count continued to tick up. Where are we today?
Yeah, we are at the highest since the start of this current wave. The KDCA saying there were 149,897 infections registered throughout Monday, among them 588 from overseas. That daily tally is the highest in about 4 months. And the number of critically ill patients also rose by 40 from the previous day to 364, the largest in about 3 months since May 11th. While there were 40 additional deaths on Monday.
And as the number of inbound foreign tourists is expected to climb this month, health authorities are planning to revive PCR testing at airports to allow them to get tested before heading into various points of the country. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, the Central Disease Control Headquarters on Tuesday said it will set up airport PCR testing sites at Incheon, Gimhae, and Jeju airports from Wednesday that will run through at least September 9th, where short-term travelers will be able to get their required test, as all international arrivals must get a PCR test within 24 hours of entry. Changes will be made to allow for PCR test reservations to be made via the pre-entry COVID-19 quarantine information input system, also known as Q code, which has been used for self-isolation exemptions. The headquarters explained the measures are aimed at minimizing infections from overseas amid a virus resurgence in the country and also the spread of the BA5 variant abroad.
Let's turn to other headlines now. In a follow-up to yesterday's news of the Education Minister stepping aside, the Education Ministry appears to have effectively withdrawn the proposed plan to lower the school starting age to 5 years old. What more can you tell us?
Yeah, briefing the Parliamentary Education Committee Tuesday, Vice Education Minister Chang Sang-yoon said it has become difficult to push forward with that controversial policy, although he declined to confirm that the plan is completely scrapped. The Vice Minister said the plan was proposed during a policy briefing to President Yoon, and that the intention of the ministry in making such a proposal was to initiate an earnest public discussion on the matter. With an aim to strengthen state responsibility in education and childcare, the vice minister pledged to gather related opinions from the public and experts, remaining open to all possibilities.
And finally, the ruling People Power Party has gone ahead with processes to appoint a new interim party chief, and now a veteran lawmaker will take on the baton.
Yeah, that's right. Five-term lawmaker Chu Ho-young has taken the role of interim chief of the People Power Party following the revision of party rules by the National Committee earlier in the day. Floor leader Kwon Song-dong obtained the right as acting party chief to appoint an interim leader. Then a general meeting of its lawmakers ratified a motion to appoint lawmaker Chu, a role he had reportedly accepted on the condition that fellow lawmakers supported the move. The party's floor spokespeople announced then the conclusion reached during a 20-minute closed-door virtual meeting held at 2 p.m. today, saying that all 73 of the PPP's 115 lawmakers who had taken part in the virtual meeting did agree to the move.
That's all for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
While South Korea reported almost 150,000 new COVID-19 cases today, North Korea reported zero suspected cases for the 11th day in a row. That's according to its state media. And there is speculation now that the regime could declare an end to the epidemic when it convenes a national meeting to review antivirus measures this month. To learn more about the coronavirus situation in North Korea, we're joined on the line now by Yifang Bremer, a Seoul correspondent at NK News. Mr. Bremer, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So the first suspected COVID-19 case in North Korea was reported by the regime back in May. Can you bring us up to speed on the overall coronavirus situation in North Korea?
Yeah, that's right. On May 12th, to be exact, DPRK announced its first ever outbreak. And now their total case number stands at about 4.7 million cases of fever, what they call. So we suspect that to be a euphemism for COVID-19. But as you said, since basically July 28th, they haven't added a single fever case to that number anymore. So that is quite surprising indeed, yeah.
Right, so we say fever and suspected COVID-19 cases because there is no capacity for widespread testing in the regime, right? And the numbers are based on those who are showing symptoms of fever.
I mean, that's what we expect to suspect, because the reality is that there are no foreign aid workers in North Korea anymore since COVID broke out. So there's no way to assess their testing methods. But what's interesting is that since last weekend, North Korea has started actually distinguishing between causes of fever. So now they're saying in the North Korean state media, some people have got fever, but because of other reasons than COVID-19, suggesting that they have actually enhanced their testing methods. But again, there's no way of verifying whether this is actually the case or not.
Right. So North Korean state media, the Korea Central News Agency, has said that 4.77 million cases of fever were reported as of last Wednesday. But we're saying we're not sure that these fever cases were indeed all COVID-19 patients, you're saying?
No, I mean, we don't know that. What's interesting is that they announced first outbreak on May 12th. And after that, they've been giving us daily updates. But what those statistics are actually worth is actually hard to say, because there's no way whether we can verify these numbers. That being said, 4.7 could be a realistic number, but their death toll, experts say, is definitely a fictional number, because right now they are still noting about only roughly 74 people have died because of COVID, but that's completely inconsistent with international statistics.
Right, so 74 deaths only out of 4.7 million suspected cases.
Yes.
That does sound rather implausible from what we know of the COVID-19 virus so far. So what do we know about how they've dealt with the outbreak? What sort of measures have they been taking?
So already before they noted their first outbreak, North Korea closed its borders to China and Russia, notably the cross-border train services. On January in 2022, China and North Korea briefly resumed the rail trade, but they already suspended it in April again. So they hermetically closed their borders to the outside world. And on May 10, if I say that correctly, we already heard from sources that a lockdown was starting in Pyongyang. That only lasted for about 3 weeks. So that's considerably shorter than in other parts of the world where they announced lockdowns. At the same time, at the border, they've implemented a shoot-on-site order for anyone crossing the border. So their focus really seems to have been on closing the border to anything that comes in. That's been their main line of defense. North Korea has yet to start a nationwide vaccination campaign. Mm. It actually rejected millions of doses offered by COVAX, according to the World Health Organization. So that's quite interesting as well.
Right, indeed. And as we said, so far, number of suspected cases, 4.7 million. Could the case number be far higher than that as well, as these are just fever symptom cases? Could there be more non-symptomatic cases as well?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we don't know about the way that North Korea actually tests these cases and what they count, what they decide to include in their statistics and whatnot. So definitely the number could be way higher. And that's also what medical experts have been telling us. And if we go back to the death rate, I was talking to a Australian infectious disease expert at Canberra Hospital and Australian National University professor. And he said that considering the fatality rate in other countries pre-vaccination, it's much more likely for the total death number to be in the tens of thousands rather than just 74.
And I also guess we have to be skeptical of the fact that the regime has not reported any cases of fever in 11 days.
Right.
For the outbreak to completely disappear like that is also quite unprecedented as well.
Yes. And they are yet to declare an end to the pandemic, but it's definitely interesting to see that they've not recorded a single case for more than 10 days. So we're also here quite curious to see what's behind that.
Could there be any possibility that the regime intentionally inflated the case numbers to perhaps essentially brag that they've been able to beat the epidemic? Is that sort of theory possible?
I mean, that's definitely possible. On the other hand, if, let's say, the whole country would be ill right now of COVID-19, that would be a lie hard to maintain. So to their credibility, perhaps the situation is also allowing the regime to take this change in communication. No, we can definitely be quite sure that these numbers are not the reality. One thing that North Korea has to its advantage is that they have a relatively young population, so the median age is around 35. So that could definitely have an impact on the death rate and how ill people get, experts tell us.
But at the same time, they are also, of course, many of them also, of course, are malnourished, so that would affect numbers as well.
Right.
As we said, North Korean state media has also reported that we'll hold a national meeting to review its emergency anti-epidemic policy in early August. And there is speculation that the regime will declare an end to the epidemic within North Korea at that meeting. What do we know at this point? What is the likelihood of that?
I mean, I don't think they'll declare, maybe they'll declare an end to the pandemic, but I don't think we should expect much when it comes to, for example, reopening the borders. Maybe for trade, maybe we can see a small window of opportunity for example, Chinese trains crossing the border with goods. Definitely not for people. If North Korea would open the borders for people again, it would definitely be one way, so people can only go out and not go in. Because they simply cannot afford the risk of importing virus with a population that's almost completely unvaccinated.
Right, so they'll be keeping a tight control of their borders. That's at least what we can expect for now.
Yes.
We've seen the COVID-19 pandemic come in waves around the world. For example, South Korea is in another wave. If North Korea declares an end to the epidemic and perhaps ease some of their measures, there remains a danger, of course, of a resurgence. Do you think they are prepared to deal with that?
I mean, there's nothing to suggest that North Korea is prepared for a resurgence, if I can be completely blunt, because, as I said, no vaccines that we know of have been administered to the general population. The quality of medical care hasn't, you know, improved overnight. So that's why I think that even if they would claim a victory over COVID, they will keep their borders shut for, you know, considerable time still. That's my expectation, at least.
Well, we will see when they will hold this meeting and what comes out of it. As a final thought, what do you think we've learned about the regime, judging by their handling of COVID-19 or their supposed handling of COVID-19?
I think there are three points that we've learned. First is that the regime understands that it's not prepared for COVID-19, and therefore shutting down the borders was their only way to basically prevent chaotic scenes within the country. Second, it kind of shows the way they completely shut down vaccines and rejected them, how paranoid and distrustful the regime is to the outside world. And I think third, the regime has learned perhaps that, you know, instilling fear to the population about external viruses is another way to control its populations and to control the flow of, you know, goods, but also information coming into the country. So I think all in all, for the North Korean people, that's very bad news altogether.
We'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Ifang Bremer, Seoul correspondent at NK News. Thank you once again for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 10.36 points, or 0.42% on Tuesday, closing the day at 2,503.46. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 2.79 points, or 0.34%, to close at 833.65. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 1.81 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,304.61. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We carry on now to Korea Trending, our daily segment looking at some of the other news stories that have been trending online today. And for that today, we have joining us on the line, Jenny Sa, to bring us those stories. Jenny, hello. It's good to talk to you today.
Good to talk to you, Jung-ho.
So what do you have on store for us today?
First, we'll talk about how a Good Samaritan tried to help reduce flooding near a subway station in Seoul after the heavy rainfall on Monday. Then we'll explore the disciplinary measures given to speed skater Kim Yoon-seok and three others for a drunk driving accident that occurred last month. And finally, we will discuss how the viral sensation Baby Shark is getting its own movie.
Right, so our first story is related to the historic rains that we saw in Seoul last night and one man's selfless act to prevent a street from flooding. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the photos of a man cleaning the street gutter near Gangnam Station with his bare hands were uploaded to an online community on Monday after the country saw a record downpour in 80 years in the Seoul metropolitan area. The man can be seen taking out piles of fallen leaves, cans, plastic bottles, and other debris that were clogging the gutter to reduce flooding without any cover from the rain.
Right. Not only was he removing the debris, but the pictures show that he was lifting the entire steel grate from the floor as well to clear it with his bare hands, as we said. Do we know if the man's efforts did manage to prevent further flooding?
Well, according to the person who put up the online post, the water that had reached up to his calves quickly went down thanks to the Good Samaritan. And people online are calling the man Gangnam Station Superman, and Ma Dong-seok, an actor known for his muscular physique and tough guy image in Korea. And they also pointed out that those who throw garbage or cigarette butts on the street should feel sorry for their actions.
Yes, a clogging in drainage systems alongside the roads that allow rainwater to escape are said to be one of the problems that caused so much damage last night.
Yes, it was confirmed in a 2015 experiment by the National Disaster Management Research Institute that if the rain gutter is clogged or covered with sediment mixed with garbage, the damage from flooding in the city center is more than three times greater. And according to a researcher at the institute, it is unlikely that the gutter will become completely clogged with natural debris such as tree branches and dirt. But if it is covered with sediment mixed with items like plastic bags, backflow occurs.
Well, the Korean internet is collectively applauding this man, the Gangnam Station Superman, a bright spot amid everything that went on last night. Okay, let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
The Korea Skating Union has suspended three-time Olympic medalist in speed skating Kim Min-seok for 18 months for a drunk driving accident that took place last month. In a hearing on Monday, the KSU gave three other speed skaters who were in the car with Kim, Jung Jae-woong, Jung Seon-kyu, and Jung Jae-won, a suspension of 12 months, 6 months, and 2 months, respectively. The union said that their driving under the influence and drunken disturbance caused a social scandal and damaged the dignity of athletes. And at the hearing, the national speed skating team's head coach, Kim Jin-soo, was also suspended for 1 year for negligence in team management.
Right, so 5 people in all have been suspended due to this incident. Can you tell us a bit more about what happened exactly?
Yes, so the 4 skaters ate and drank near the National Training Center in Jincheon on the evening of July 22nd after getting permission to leave the premises from the head coach. And after the meal, Jung Jae-woong drove Kim's vehicle under the influence back to the training center. And then upon receiving a call from an acquaintance about a birthday party, Kim got back in his car and drove to the welcome center of the training facilities with Jung Seon-kyu and Jung Jae-woong. And after the party, Kim ran into a sidewalk block where he drove back into the training center and is said to have left the car there without reporting the accident, but the incident was all caught on surveillance camera. And Jung Jae-woong was suspended for driving under the influence of alcohol, and Jung Seon-kyu and Jung Jae-won for getting in the car with intoxicated drivers.
Okay, so in the long term then, what does this mean for Kim, the Olympic medalist behind the wheel? Will he still be able to compete in future Olympics?
Yes, he actually can. His suspension will have been completed by the time he is due to compete in the 2026 Winter Olympics in Italy. And in response to concerns that the punishment is too light, the head of the KSU said that while Kim's punishment did take into account his past achievements like the Olympic medals, a suspension of 1 year and 6 months is fatal for an athlete's career.
Well, I guess we'll see about that and whether he does lose his place for 2026 because of the suspension and lack of involvement in the national setup. In the meantime, let's move on to our last story, and it's about the musical YouTube sensation that is Baby Shark. Can you tell us more, Jenny?
Yes, a feature-length animated film of Baby Shark will be released next year, according to its creator, the Pink Fong Company, on Monday. The film is co-produced by the Pink Fong Company and Nickelodeon, and it will be released in the U.S. market next year due to streaming service Paramount Plus.
Right, so Baby Shark is the latest to follow this trend of having a movie made out of their IP. But Baby Shark was originally just a song. What will the movie be about?
The movie is tentatively titled Baby Shark's Big Movie, and it follows the adventures of Brooklyn Baby Shark as he leaves for a new city and fights an evil starfish named Stariana in order to keep peace in the ocean. And the main character will be voiced by Kimiko Glenn from the TV series Orange is the New Black. And Brooklyn's best friend William will be voiced by actor Luke Youngblood from the film Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. And Alan Foreman, the award-winning producer of several children's animated series, will be directing the film.
Right, I guess a movie is no surprise considering the song became such a cultural phenomenon around the world, Jenny.
Yes. The original Baby Shark dance video became the world's first YouTube video to reach 10 billion views. And then the 2021 TV animated spin-off, Baby Shark's Big Show, recorded the highest viewership ratings for U.S. children's series in the second quarter of 2022, according to the head of Pink Fong's U.S. branch, Jung Yeon-bin. And Jung said that the success of the TV series demonstrated the potential of family entertainment and that they will provide fresh fun to audiences with a movie that expands on the original characters and story.
So Baby Shark, the movie, coming to us in 2023. Mm-hmm. That's where we'll wrap it up for today's Career Trending. Thank you for those stories, Jenny, and we will speak to you next time.
Speak to you next time.
Our guest this week for Touch Basin's Hole is Korean-Australian Paul Sa, who is a two-time world debate champion. He's also the former coach of the Australian National Debating Team, as well as the Harvard College Debating Union. Based on his experiences and what his debate skills have taught him about life, he has written a book published early this year called Good Arguments. In the UK, I believe he has a different title, The Art of Disagreeing Well. I'm delighted to say that he joins us via video today. Mr. Sa, welcome to the show.
안녕하세요. 반갑습니다. It's an honor to be on this program. Thank you.
Yes, 안녕하세요. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Your book starts with you talking about how you moved to Australia from South Korea when you were just 8 years old. You spoke no English at the time. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about that story and how you ended up joining a debate club in the first place?
The first thing I learned when I moved from South Korea to Australia is that the hardest part of crossing language lines is adjusting to real life conversation, and that the hardest conversations to adjust to are disagreements. That's when passions run and the rhythms of ordinary speech start to break down and people start to interrupt. And that, coupled with the sense that my differences from my peers, if exposed, could mark me out as a bit of an outsider, that made me resolve to be very agreeable, to nod and smile and keep most of my thoughts to myself. And the thing that broke me out of that posture of conflict aversion was a promise that my fifth grade teacher made me, which was that in debate, when one person speaks, no one else does. And to someone who had been spoken over and interrupted and spun out of conversation, that sounded pretty irresistible. And I took up that opportunity and joined the team.
Right, so it helped you find your voice at a time when you found it difficult, especially in a second language. Was debate then something you enjoyed right from the beginning?
I enjoyed that opportunity to be heard from the beginning, but there is still a process because it's not just being heard in the way that you might be heard if you're public speaking or something like that, or if you're just given a platform to speak. You're still disagreeing with someone. And that requires not only that bit of silence and that platform, but it also requires a set of skills that's going to back you up that you can rely on so that when we're at our most vulnerable, which is disagreeing with someone, we have something that we can rely on.
In those early days, what did you take away from that experience in debate? And how did that help you as you grew older, as you went through school and as you went through uni and started to build a career as well?
There's a book about that. I think the first is that disagreeing is a skill. It's not something that just visits upon us like a natural disaster. It's something that we should prepare for, that we should work on as a craft, as a kind of an art. And those skills are transferable to all those different arenas of life that you spoke about, right? The gathering information and marshalling evidence and putting it in the form that's going to be most persuasive is what we do at school. It's what we do in the workplace. It's what we have to do in the home sometimes. It's certainly what we do when we engage with the political sphere. So I think the first is a view of disagreement as a skill and not just as a kind of an event. And I think the second thing I would say is once you've made that jump, you can start to see disagreement as something more than just a source of pain and division. That the best disagreements have a kind of richness. They call for a growth that sitting around the circle agreeing with one another can't really hope to achieve. So I think even at that young age, I was circling around something that I think is really truthful about the human condition, which is we show ourselves most fully, we push ourselves to grow in unexpected ways when we look at our differences head on and we step into conversation about them.
So even just speaking to you for a couple of minutes now, it seems that you have a very philosophical take on debate and arguing and disagreements. And I'm guessing that's what led you to write your book, Good Arguments, that you wanted to share what you've learned and try to help people. Is that what was behind the thinking behind the book?
There was something philosophical about it. I mean, debate to me is an answer to a really ancient question, which is what do we do about the fact that we're all different, but we have to coexist? And debate isn't the only answer to that question, but I think it's one useful contribution. And I wanted in the book to bridge as much as possible that philosophical insight or that discussion with things that people can practically do. Because even though I'm speaking about it in a kind of elevated way, at the end of the day, this is an activity that we do as children. And so I wanted readers to be able to learn the lessons in a way that would be digestible, practical, something they could implement. But I don't want to trivialize an activity by saying it's what children do, because in fact, I think they are circling around, you know, these themes that go to the essence of who we are and what it means to live with one another.
What triggered you to actually make the decision to write the book? I understand there was a political event that really pushed you over to actually making the decision to write this book.
I think there were two triggers for my wanting to write this book. The first is I won the world championships a second time, the university's world championships in January 2016. And I was first approached to write this book then. And if I wrote it then, you know, it would have been about helping people discover their voice, right? To be able to make their case, to be heard. All of those things are really important. And I thought perhaps if I could say something useful about that, help someone with that, that would be time well spent. So that would be the first impetus. But the second one, and the one that was quite formative for how this book turned out, was what happened several months after I won the world championships, which was the US presidential campaign between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And what you saw in that incredibly divisive moment in American history was that the debates where the two candidates came face to face became not only a symbol for this era of polarization that it helped usher in or to reveal, but it also became a driver of that. So we saw the debate stage being hijacked in such a way that degraded the public conversation rather than enhanced it. And so that pushed me to think not only about debate as a set of skills that can be passed on, but also an opportunity to reflect on what we want our disagreements to do for us and what the limits and uses of disagreement might be.
Right. So it was essentially the divisiveness, the polarization that we were seeing in politics that perhaps called on you to write this book and to try and essentially help and give back to people as well what you've learned. Your book is part memoir, part advice on competitive debate, but also on how to deal with everyday arguments and disagreements in everyday conversation, relationships and education, even technology as well, I understand. We, of course, encourage our listeners and viewers to seek out the book to learn more about what you want to teach us. But perhaps what is the one kernel of advice that you can give us today? You talk about how the divisiveness you saw in the world led you to write this book. How can debate help us, especially if you are even afraid of engaging or it seems too daunting?
One of the things that makes disagreements daunting is the sense that it can run away from us, right? We wade into it and all of a sudden, kind of like a whirlwind, it starts pulling in all these other disputes. It gets bigger, the volume starts increasing and so on. And I think one bit of advice that might help with that is that every disagreement should start with some agreement. And that's most fundamentally what we're agreeing about, right? So when we say we're arguing today about whose turn it is to do the laundry, right? That's all we're arguing about. We're not arguing about what happened last week and you know, how you looked at me the other day, all of those other things. We can get to that. But for now, we're going to talk about this particular subject. And we're also going to agree to conduct our disagreement in certain ways and not others. So we're going to take turns when we speak, so we're not interrupting each other. We're going to give each other an equal amount of time to be heard in this exchange, right? And so I would start every disagreement with that little period of negotiation. And just in terms of how you framed the question, which I think is quite right, I mean, the book came out of a desire to be useful in this time. And for me, the day-to-day disagreements of how we conduct our conversations around the kitchen table, in the office conference room, those things are not disconnected from our political moment, right? And it is, in fact, what I think we can do as individuals, in addition to all the other institutional structural things we're going to have to do to try and unsettle some of the worst tendencies that I think are tending to dominate our public conversations.
I understand that there are plans for your book to be published in Korea, in Korean. Can you tell us about that? And what do you hope Korean readers take away from the book as well? Is there anything different that you think they can take away from it?
I'm so excited for the book to come out, and it's being translated now, and it should be some number of months before Munak Dongne publishes it on that side. And I feel really very honored to work with one of the great publishers of the world, and not just of Korea. I see it as a homecoming for me. In some ways, though the story starts as a story of immigration, a lot of my values and outlooks are shaped by my parents, who are Korean, and by my childhood, just growing up in Seoul. And in some ways, Korea, because it's a divided country, because it's a country surrounded, right, by kind of regional powers with a history of conflict, there's no way of running away from this,
sure,
which is the project that we have to be involved in, which is finding better ways to manage our differences. So I'm very excited to see how readers receive it. It's a learned culture. It's a scholarly culture. So I think there'll be an interest from just the education element of it too. But I think that theme of finding better ways to disagree, I think Koreans are no strangers to, and I'm looking forward to engaging in conversation about that when I get there.
Do you think Korean people debate or argue any differently? Korean politics is also very polarized as well, of course. I'm not sure if you've seen the political debates here in Korea.
I do watch it a little bit. I mean, I think the first thing is, it feels like the passions are very alive in our day-to-day conversations. And they reveal themselves with a fullness, maybe more so than I see in some other countries. And I think the other thing maybe about disagreement in Korea is it feels quite democratic in some way, which is a lot of people do it a lot. and there's a lot of conversation. And I think where there's conversation, there's hope. And it's a matter of trying to do it better.
And very briefly, what's next for you? I'm sure you're very busy with the release of this book. But I understand you are also a student at Harvard Law School as well now. So it seems you're looking to make a debate part of your career.
Yes, I think that's right. It is a different form of debate and a different language of arguing. And I'm really enjoying learning that and seeing the differences between the background that I bring and the one that I'm entering into. And I'm hoping, you know, I'm a believer that arguing requires the best of you, that it's a vote of confidence in the best of the other side. And in some ways, the legal system is premised on those ideas. So that's the phase of my career that I'm going into.
Well, I must say it's been fascinating to talk to you today. We really appreciate your time. We've been speaking to Paul Ha, the author of Good Arguments, which is out now in English and coming soon in Korean as well. Mr. Ha, thank you once again for your time.
Thank you so much. It's an enormous honor and I enjoyed the conversation.
This is violinist Lee Ji-yoon, concertmaster at Staatskapelle Berlin. You are listening to Korea 24.
We finish up the show, as usual, with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And for that, we have our staff editor, Richard Larkin, joining us in the studio once again. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Django. Good to see you too.
Okay, so where are we headed to first?
First is an article from the Life and Style section of the Korea Herald. It was written by Kim Hae-yeon, and it is quite a bizarre story about a furniture promotion video. This particular video has been facing public criticism since it was released last Friday.
Okay, so furniture promotion video, right. Why has it been receiving criticism?
That's because of where the video was filmed. The advertisement showed a sofa placed at multiple locations within Cheonghwa-dae, the former presidential office compound.
Right.
An 8-minute video was uploaded on the streaming service platform Babayo's YouTube channel. It was called Everywhere Episode 1, Cheonghwa-dae. The advertisement shows people's reactions to a large white sofa by Shinsegae Kasa, one of Korea's largest furniture makers. In the video, people find a piece of furniture in different parts of Cheonghwa-dae and ask staff if a former president had sat on the sofa. The video also showed people relaxing in the middle of the compound.
Right, so a large white sofa around Cheonghwa-dae and people are reacting to it. That's quite a unique idea for a promotional video. Did the company then break rules by filming the video there?
They did. According to current guidelines, all space within the compound can be rented out for filming, but only for non-commercial purposes. The entertainment and media firm IHQ, the company that made the video, said it had verbally informed the Cultural Heritage Administration that some furniture may be used as props. But it also admitted that it had not made a written formal request for permission from the CHA. On Monday, the CHA asked that IHQ take down the advertisement, and from what I can see, the video has been deleted.
Okay, so it seemed they got permission to film there, but yes, not for promotional purposes. It is rather odd. I'm sure people there would have seen the sofa there, and they must have thought, what is that there for?
Yeah.
Perhaps if they'd stopped to think about it, it would have thought it was perhaps for a promotional video. Mm-hmm. But yes, the cheek of it as well to try and pull this off. It's quite interesting.
It is a unique idea, I got to admit, though.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so you can understand what the controversy is about. At least they have taken down the video now. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to our next story. What do you have for us?
The next article is about an Australian artist called Casey Tosh. John Dunbar's interview with the artist can be found in the Foreign Community section of the Korea Times. It goes into detail about why he moved to South Korea and about his work.
Okay, so why did Tosh then move to Korea?
Well, the artist was working in Australia when he felt he needed a change. In his home country, he was selling his work for between $1,000 to $6,000 a piece. But he wanted to move on to projects like murals and screen-printed clothing in a different country. So in 2019, Tosh moved to Korea. He doesn't really explain why he chose Korea, though.
Right. Okay, so we don't know why he chose Korea, but he was looking for a different background, somewhere new to, I guess, inspire him.
Exactly.
Can you tell us more about his art style?
Well, according to the interview, the style is classed as neo-expressionist or trans-avant-garde. The characters he paints usually have intense expressions. Tosh says that the people he paints usually have one way or another influenced his way of thinking or his work. Some examples are Mike Tyson, Dennis Rodman, and skateboarder Mark Gonzalez. They are also likable, cheeky, or mischievous characters who have achieved a high level in their professions.
Okay, so people that a lot of people will be familiar with. How can people see his work then?
Well, he does have an exhibition coming up from August 13th to the 27th. It's called Television Personalities, and it will be held at Mudaeruk near Hongik University. At the event, people will also be able to listen to music from four DJs from the UK and the US. So if you're interested in art or maybe DJ music, this might be an exhibition for you to check out.
Sounds like an interesting event. So we'll wrap it up there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Richard, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you.
And that's where we wrap up our show. Thank you for staying with us. We will be back same time tomorrow. So we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.